With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Royal Automobile Club talk show in association with Motorsport. Now, some of you might know who I am, but others will have absolutely no idea. So I'm Ed Foster, and I'm back at the helm of these recordings. Joining me today is features editor Simon Aaron.
Good afternoon.
And our special guest, Adrian Newey.
Hello.
So new Formula One fans could be mistaken for thinking that Adrian's career started and ended at Red Bull, but the truth is very far from that. He worked at Fittipaldi, Beatrice, March, designing sports cars and Indy cars, then returned to the Formula One paddock, the March, Leighton House, and then Williams, McLaren, and then finally Red Bull. And in that time, you won 10 championships between 92 and 2013, an astonishing record. To give a little bit of background as to why we're here, there is a special dinner in your honour tonight after winning Motoring Book of the Year last year with your How to Build a Car. I've read it, and I have to say, I blame you entirely for the burn I got on my back reading it on a beach. And it was the one book I took on holiday, and I finished it in a day. So there was a lot of sitting around.
That was quick reading. Yeah. It took me a lot longer to write it.
No, I can imagine. Why a book now? What was it that kind of brought this on?
That's a very good question. Over the years, I was approached by various publishers to write a book, and it never really felt right. Now, to be perfectly honest, I was going to leave it until after I'd retired before I did so. And then Jack Fogg from HarperCollins approached me with an idea to kind of tell the story of how I went about the design of 12 or so cars that I've been involved in. And I thought, well, okay, that's quite a nice idea, but if I'm going to do that, I might as well make it an autobiography and tell the whole thing, because I'm never going to get around to writing two books. And that was it. Got into it.
And do you there must have been a huge amount of satisfaction when you kind of got that done. And was the process quite difficult? Because obviously, as an engineer, you haven't written that many books in your life. How was the process? And that sort of sense of completion at the end must have been quite nice.
Yeah, it was. I mean, it's. I think Jack was very optimistic in telling me how long it would take me. But I'm not one who normally spends a lot of time sort of looking back and reflecting, and kind of tend to live in the in the present and future. So writing the book was kind of, I think it's an old thing, but quite cathartic. It was quite nice to look back and try and remember everything, which is my first problem. My memory is absolutely awful, so I thought it might be a very short book. But once I started, then it all started to come back. Worked very closely with a ghostwriter who was absolutely excellent to work with, and it was actually a really pleasurable experience.
So what's actually more difficult, crafting a book or designing a Red Bull RB7?
Very different, and that's, I guess, as I've got older, that's what I now enjoy, is actually being involved in different things. An example, my daughter's in the hotel industry now, and so I've also been involved with some of the hotels she's been working in, developing from derelict buildings into running concerns. And, you know, that sort of variety, I think, is quite exciting for me.
Can you build a hotel with more downforce than another hotel? I don't know. How does that work?
Try to build it with more style. It doesn't always work.
So today we're going to sort of meander through lots of the bits and pieces that you brought up in the book. And some of them are well-known, some of them are lesser-known. But before we went anywhere, I read that the New Yorker referred to you as the Michelangelo of motorsport, which I thought was quite a nice phrase. So just to kind of to tee us off, what do you consider to be your Sistine Chapel, you know, throughout your career?
Crikey, that's a difficult one. I think probably the car in many ways I'm most proud of, although never won a race was the first Leighton House March car. That was 1988. It was my first Formula One car. And I think, well, at the time, it was the back end of the turbo era, and cars had kind of got very big and clumsy, with ever more powerful engines and ever bigger rear wings to then create the downforce. We only had a normally aspirated engine, which is probably best part of 200 horsepower down. So I figured that if we were going to be competitive, the only way to do it would be to come up with a much more aerodynamically efficient package. So we went for a very small car, very tightly packaged, and really emphasizing trying to maximize the downforce. And it kind of it changed the direction of Formula One a little bit, in as much as subsequently people either directly copied, well, close to directly copied, or at least made their cars quite a lot smaller and more aerodynamic. And it raised the profile of aerodynamics within Formula One, I would say.
It was, sorry, Simon, it was so tightly packaged that you didn't have space for the driver's knuckles, did you?
No, there were a few little mistakes in it. Actually, the first, so our lead driver is Ivan Capelli, who had done one season of Formula One at that time. Lovely chap, Italian, very enthusiastic. And so we kind of built a rough mock-up of the car and sat him in it, cockpit mock-up, and he said yes, and we sort of brought the pedals towards him and tried different pieces and said, yes, I'm okay with that. And then when he actually drove it, suddenly he wasn't okay with it. I think his enthusiasm got the better of him a bit, and it was my mistake. It was I should have, with hindsight, been a bit more less pushy in trying to package him as tightly. But we got to the first test in Imola, and he quite simply couldn't change gear. He hadn't got enough room for the gear lever. So the evening of that first test, I think I slightly shocked the mechanics by saying, okay, leave me to it, you go off to the hotel rooms. And I worked through the night, cut a hole in the monocoque, made a max moulding of the blister shape, took a mould of that, and then made the blister, laminated it up, and put bonded that back into the chassis. And so the mechanics came back in the morning, all they had to do was paint it green. Which was good in a way, because it kind of helped to establish that I could be involved with them and could understand their side of it as well.
A slight tangent, but I was just going to...
Sound like you, Simon.
Yeah, well, yeah. Just on the subject of Capelli, he was a Formula 3 champion. He won the Formula 3000 title with a tiny little team run from Cesare Garibaldi's backyard, more or less, and half a dozen mechanics, if that. Very talented guy, but... And he showed that a couple of seasons with you. And then it just all kind of went pear-shaped when he went to Ferrari. What, I mean, how did you rate him, and where do you think it went wrong?
I mean, well, he's a lovely chap. In terms of his driving abilities, you say, I mean, through the junior films, he was sensational. And when he was with us in those years at Leighton House, he was, to me, a very, very good driver. Difficult to judge, of course, had we had another driver in the car, of where he would have been, because, as you say, it was very strange that only went to Ferrari and subsequently Jordan, and really did absolutely nothing. Some drivers are quite affected by their confidence in the team around them and how much support they feel, etc. Emotional drivers, if you like, and I think Ivan was one of those. And so when he kind of, if you like, didn't get the love at Ferrari, and perhaps, I guess, that lost his confidence, and then he went to Jordan, where I'm sure he would have got the love from EJ, he still wasn't able to get back to form.
Now, we've got so much to talk about, but to start things, I wanted to rewind to 83, the Daytona 24 Hours. And it's a lovely part of the book where you talk through the drivers that you had that year. Randy Lehner, who was excellent. Terry Walters, who had thick Benny Hill glasses and couldn't see at night. Marty Hines, who had permanently dilated pupils. And Ken Murray, who could barely change gear. This was obviously with the 83G, the March. Just talk, because you shook it down at Donington with Tiff very briefly. So just talk us through, you know, that weekend and what you had to go through.
I guess it was the weekend in some ways that launched my career, or brought me to the attention certainly of Robin Hurd, who was the boss of March at the time. where there'd been an unloved sports car that had raced at Le Mans in 82 and was kind of lying around. I had done my final year project at Southampton University on ground effect aerodynamics applied to sports cars. So I said to Robin, look, what's happening to this car? Maybe I can do something with it. And he said, okay, well, you can have a go, but there's no budget for wind tunnel testing. You'll have to do it by eye. So, okay. So anyway, I did various aerodynamic modifications to it and a bit of design work to get quite a lot of weight out of it as well. And as you say, we took it up to Donington with Tiff Nadal, did a shakedown lap of about probably 20 laps, if that. And then it's packed off to go to Daytona. So not the best preparation for a 24-hour race. Anyway, we arrived, ran the car. Ken Murray, the owner of the car.
This was the one who couldn't change gear.
Yeah, so he had a Ferrari Testarossa road car and fancied himself as a racing driver. And somehow or other, he'd managed to get an entry at Daytona. God knows how. So, yes, he couldn't drive the car. He couldn't change gear. So I managed to persuade him that, you know, maybe it was best to develop his talents a little bit before racing at Daytona. So managed to talk him out of driving the car. And effectively became, as well as the supplied race engineer by March, the team manager, because there was no team manager. The car was pretty unreliable. We had lots of problems with it through practice. Qualified very much midfield. It was all a bit disappointing. And then kind of each day, or at the end of the day, the job list got longer rather than shorter as we went through. So I was kind of hands-on with the mechanics, trying to help. So we were up all night, the night before qualifying and the night before the race. So going into the race, I think we probably had about, I don't know, 6 hours sleep in the previous 48, and figured it wouldn't really be a problem because the thing would probably break down after 2 hours and we could all go back to the hotel room. Anyway, I mean, it's unbelievable by today's standards, but in those days there was no kind of timing screen showing where your positions and so forth on the pit wall. So we had a group of girls who would do the lap charts to show where you were. Any of the girls that had been supplied weren't quite up to us and got lost after about an hour. So we kept running, and I just tried to keep Randy in the car as much as possible. Randy and Marty, really. Tried to rev limited them because we were very worried about the reliability of the engine, and just kept going round, really. And I remember actually, as its darkness fell, we were doing a driver change. I can't remember who was the tall or who was the short one. One of them was quite short. I think it was Randy. So as he got out, I did help with the seatbelts and so forth. So I took his seat padding, which is a sort of round frisbee, chucked it, and it did exactly that. It frisbeed off over the top of the pit, over the top of the garage, and landed on the top of the garage roof. So once the pit stop was all over, I then had to clamber up in the middle of the night, find the said piece of frisbee padding, recover it, and get it ready for the next stop. Anyway, the race went on, and about 11 o'clock at night, I'm not honestly sure, I went off to the lavatory, and as you walk in, I looked up, and just like Indianapolis, there's a sort of vertical tower scoreboard, and there P1 was car 66. Didn't really think of it, anything of it. I was kind of standing at the urinal thinking, 66, I know that. That's us. And we were leading, and we actually stayed in the lead from, I guess that was probably about the sixth hour or so, through to 2 hours from the end when there was a heavy rainstorm. They actually red flagged the race and then got going again, but we got a misfire from watering the ignition and finished second. And on the back of that, Robin Hurd managed to sell a whole load more of the 83Gs, and that kind of, I guess, brought my name to the attention of March as not simply being a junior draftsman, an occasional race engineer on the Formula 2 car, to somebody that he should put a bit of trust in.
So talking of Formula 2, didn't Christian Danner actually sack you as his race engineer at one point in the early 80s?
After my very first race.
Simon's great at bringing up the best memories.
Yeah, no,
he mentioned Formula 2.
Yeah, no, my race engineering career was nearly cut very short at the grand total of one race.
What were the circumstances?
The circumstances were that first of all, I joined March from Fittipaldi. Fittipaldi as a team, it's clear they're losing their money and it was time to move on before they folded. So I was astute enough to do so and had two job offers, one from Lotus as an aerodynamicist and one from March as a race engineer at the weekends and a junior draftsman during the week. The obvious thing would have been to go to Lotus as an aerodynamicist, and kind of since the Lotus was always the team that my parents and myself had kind of supported, if you like, when I was younger. But I thought, no, I've now done 18 months as an aerodynamicist at Fittipaldi. If I go to March, I can start to get experience in the other two disciplines of race engineering and mechanical design. So I did that, and what I hadn't banked on was that I guess almost no experience of race engineering before the first race. I think I wore a set of headphones once for a test at Thruxton or somewhere, I can't honestly remember, and then it was straight into the first race. So I was incredibly wet behind the ears. We got through it was a very wet weekend, and in the race, about three laps or so from the end, with I think Christian might have even been leading, the car conked out. No fuel. So I was immediately blamed of having not put enough fuel in the car. Christian, understandably enough, lost his cool and said, I don't want this wet young engineer working on my car anymore. As it turned out, it was actually a fuel leak that caused him to run out. But unfortunately, by then, the damage was done. And, you know, in a way, I don't blame Christian. His career was obviously on the line, he was desperately trying to develop his career. The last thing he wanted was some inexperienced race engineer. What was remarkable is that it was a three-car team, and Johnny Cicotto, who was one of the other drivers, said, okay, I'll take Adrian. And so Johnny's race engineer, Ralph Bellamy, went onto Christian's car, and I went onto Johnny's. And we had a great relationship through the year. Lovely, lovely person, Venezuelan, and we ended up taking it down to the wire and finishing second in the championship.
Talking of relationships with drivers, is it true to say that the first close relationship you had was with Bobby Rahal in 83? How was it? What was different about him, you know, back in 83? And then we can go on to talk about the Jaguar thing afterwards. But he was a very special driver. What would you like to work with?
Well, it was actually 84, but...
Sorry.
No, don't worry. So
it was actually Simon who did these notes.
Sloping shoulders. I did my race engineering with Johnny in 82 and started to learn the ropes a bit. A bit of race engineering... Well, that Daytona race wasn't race engineering, that was survival. But then with Al Holbert in the sports car towards the start, once he bought the March 83G, did a couple of races with him, but still a fairly inexperienced race engineer, in truth. Anyway, Robin Heard, as sort of part of his earned money from the Americans, had this policy of flogging his lending his engineers, leasing his engineers effectively out to the teams that are running marches. So I was sent out to be race engineer at True Sports for Bobby Rahal for the 84 IndyCar season. And that was another huge learning curve. IndyCars, I think, a very interesting challenge because just like Formula One or other series, you have the road tracks and, if you like, the conventional street tracks, race tracks like Silverstone and so forth, which are normally much faster corners than the street tracks. But then in addition to that, you have the short ovals, the 1 mile ovals, and then the 2.5 mile super speedways. And they require very different skills, both of the driver and of the race engineer, particularly kind of the first test at Phoenix Short Oval, which was the first test I went to with Bobby and True Sports. The car was sitting there and it's kind of looked as if the accident's happened already, you know, every single wheel's at a different camber angle, the car's tilted, which means it's kind of sitting left hand down, nothing square. And it's from a race engineering perspective, it's actually a very interesting challenge, because particularly super speedways like Indianapolis, all four corners are within a few miles an hour, the same speed. So if the driver comes in and says it's understeering on a normal street track, or racetrack, I should say, then you know you've got a variety of tools that you might choose. You might soften the front anti-roll bar. You might increase the front wing. Other changes. On the ovals, you have a plethora of changes you can make because you only have to worry about turning left, and there's no kind of range of corner speeds to give you more of a clue of what you should do. There's no kind of braking entry exit because it's more or less a constant speed. So trying to understand how you should actually adjust the car when you don't have the normal clues, if you like, is an interesting challenge. And I've found it absolutely fascinating doing that. But I think, sorry, I've gone off piece. I do apologise. In terms of your original question, Bobby, I think I was very young. Bobby was a much more experienced driver, hence I actually grew a beard at that time because all the drivers I was race engineering were quite a lot older than me, so I tried to make myself look older, then shaved it off, and now I'm trying to make myself look younger, but there we go. I don't know, for whatever reason, we kind of bonded as a chemistry between race engineer and driver, where he could report on the car, I could translate what he was saying into, if you like, an engineering solution. He would then go off and drive it and would trust me to come up with hopefully a step forwards. And so we just developed a really strong relationship. Plus, I think one of the things that helped a lot with Indy or the IndyCar series is the teams are very small. We very often traveled together in these sort of effectively minibuses from circuit to circuit. So you're on the road, if you like it, literally. We would very often eat dinner together. So, you know, come Friday evening, Bobby and I would sit down, have dinner, and inevitably, of course, discuss the car and the problems. And sometimes from that, I would then go back into the circuit or get into the circuit early the next day to get the setup changed again from what I thought should be done on prior to the dinner. So I think all those things helped develop. And it's interesting, if you ask me which two drivers do I feel I developed the best race engineering connection with, I'd probably say Bobby Rahal and Mario Andretti, both obviously IndyCar drivers.
And is that partly the fact that in Formula One there is more separation? I mean, because teams don't, I mean, it's not like the 60s and 70s where teams travelled around as units and you didn't have the same integration of an evening, for example. Do you think that's actually played a part in the fact that you didn't have that relationship with any of your Grand Prix drivers?
I think it's partly that. I mean, when I got into Formula One, it was Ivan Capelli and Richo Guzman. So part of it, of course, is you've gone from a one-car team to a two-car team. All the IndyCar teams I work for are one-car teams. I think Ivan, for whatever reason, and Mauricio, I never developed that relationship. Probably the next time, really, was Damon Hill at Williams, where in 96, after his race engineer had left for McLaren, I ended up race engineering for that season. And that became quite a close relationship. But I think as the years go on, for me, several things have happened. I've kind of ended up not being a race engineer at the weekends, because I've unfortunately quite a few other things to do. And the teams have got much bigger, so that does tend to make it a bit more impersonal. And finally, nowadays, there's so much data to look through that typically on a Friday night, we just don't leave the circuit until way past dinner time. So we grab a quick bite at the circuit, and then get back to it, and then finally peel off for the hotel room. by the time you get to Saturday, it's all under the Parc Fermé regulations. It's all done and dusted. You can't change the
plus
car
anymore. I mean, you don't need the driver to talk to you as much anyway, because Dell or Hewlett-Packard talks to you anyway. So,
yes and no. I mean, you're right. All the data we record tells you a lot about what the car does. But it's only the driver that can tell you why it's doing it. So drivers are incredibly intuitive beasts. So if a car has a handling deficiency, for instance, if it has a very nervous entry where as he's braking and turning into the corner, the rear wants to come round, then what he will do is he will take a much shallower entry so that he's not turning as much as he's braking, which will cover that aspect. But the result will be that then he's got too much turning to do when he gets to the apex of the corner, and so he will come in and say it's understeering. Mika Hakkinen was one of the worst for that until he figured it out. So but if you looked at the data, it will simply say the car's understeering because the driver's masked it.
Yeah.
And so you have to marry the two, and I do actually enjoy that side of it, and that's something that has changed since the 80s and even the very early 90s, where now you can marry what the driver's saying with what the data's telling you, and then try and kind of be mindful and intelligent in actually what's really happening.
Just rewinding briefly to 96, you say you developed a very close relationship with Damon that season. So how did you feel when the bombshell dropped at Hockenheim? Well, you might well have been in the loop by then, I don't know, but when the news broke that Damon was being pitched?
I didn't know about it until after Damon did. So, when I read about it in the newspaper, I think, or Damon came in with a foul scowl on his face. That was, you know, Williams was a great team to work for. Frank and Patrick Frank Williams and Patrick Head were both treated me extremely well. And Patrick gave me a lot of leeway to get on with the design of the car whilst he ran the engineering functions of the car, of the team. And I thoroughly enjoyed my time there. But what you have to remember about Williams is it was always Frank and Patrick's hobby shop. And not in any malicious way, it was run by those two having lunch together. And they kind of, when it came to consultation, you know, by then, by 96, I felt, having, I think, run three or four championships by then, I did feel, and they both promised that it should be a kind of three-party, I should be involved in the decision-making process, even if ultimately it was going to be their call. And unfortunately, I think, as I say, not necessarily in a malicious way, they just kept forgetting they've operated that way so many times that they just got on with it. And so Damon not having a drive for 96 was a huge shock. I mean, first of all, we had the shock of Jacques Villeneuve being chosen, which was kind of not what Frank and Patrick had agreed prior to Jack's test at Silverstone, where they said we agreed that if he was, I think David Coulthard had gone out and set a benchmark time, and we said, okay, if Jack's within 1.5 seconds or something, I mean, it's quite a big band, then we'll give him another test and consider it. I think he was in the event 2 seconds off, and was automatically given the drive by Frank and Patrick, which I never understood without. So quite a lot of things were going on at the time. And I did feel I thought it was wrong for Damon to be treated that way. And it was not wholly, but partly because of that I decided, okay, it's time probably for me to move on and join another team.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
To rewind the clock a little bit to an earlier period at Williams, there's a lovely, it's about two pages in your book, where you run through some of the tricks that Mansell used to play on Patrese. Please just remind us of them, because everything from the initial weigh-in all the way through to how he took a chicane, you know, so quickly, they were just brilliant.
Well, I mean, particularly if a driver's driving for a team where it looks like there's a good chance of winning the championship, then his main rival becomes his teammate. And I think Nigel was smart enough to realise very early in 92 that the 14B was a car that could deliver a championship, and therefore what he needed to focus on was beating Ricciardo. And Nigel's a great games player, in an amusing way, I have to say. He didn't do it in an underhand way. So the two tricks I particularly remember was one was that season there's still no kind of the car wasn't car weight it was car weight plus driver, so didn't the car weight was, I can't remember, about 500 kilos, and then you added the driver on. So, but for some reason the FIA decided they would start measuring the driver's weight with the view to then the following season making the total weight including the driver, not just the car. So for the first weigh-in at Kyle Army, the first race, then Nigel had decided he wanted to prove that had been really fit and he was now lighter than Ricciardo. So he dehydrated himself for 24 hours. He took all the lining out of his helmet. I think he took all the lining out of his shoes. He probably didn't wear any underwear, I don't know. Went for the weigh-in. Came in with a number. Ricciardo had been training like mad through the whole winter. He did look fully buffed, whereas Nigel still had that slight sort of burger-eating Brummy look to him. Anyway, through Nigel's crash diet and removal of bits of clothing, then he came in about half a kilo lighter. And that actually destroyed. Ricciardo just couldn't believe it. And it's funny how little things like that can mess with the driver's head. And I think the Italian drivers, Ivan Capelli, we mentioned earlier, and another Italian driver, they seem to be, as an observation, they can be a bit fragile in the head. Valentino Rossi clearly is a huge exception to that, but some of the Formula One drivers I've worked with them have been a little bit fragile when it comes to that sort of stuff. So that seemed to phase Ricciardo a bit. And then much later in the season, we had this business at Monza where Nigel was a huge amount quicker through the chicanes, the first chicane and the first and second chicanes. And Ricciardo just couldn't suss it. Anyway, Patrick Head went over to see Nigel and said to him, "Nigel, how is it that you are so much faster than Ricciardo?" And Nigel says, "Oh, it's very simple, really. What I do is when I get to the chicane, I turn the wheel and I jam my knuckles like that so the steering wheel can't move and it can't kick back, you see." He said, "Ah, right." So he went over. "Ricciardo, what you need to do is jam your knuckles like this." So Ricciardo went out, did a couple of laps, came back in with, I think his gloves were blue sort of fabric in this area. And you could see blood oozing through. Completely skinned all his knuckles and had to wear plasters for the rest of the weekend. It was a complete wind-up on Nigel's part.
But there was also the two debriefs as well. And there was obviously the kind of the debrief with Ricciardo's side of the garage, but then they went off and had a separate debrief. And I think he basically just said whatever would send Ricciardo in the wrong direction in the big team debrief.
Yes, I mean, that was naughty because it was obviously gamesmanship, but from a team point of view, it meant we weren't learning about the car. and indeed Montreal in particular that year. Nigel Self sent himself off in the wrong direction, and because he went in the wrong direction, actually caused Ricardo, who was following what he thought Nigel was doing, to go in the wrong direction as well. Because what Nigel was doing, as you say, was he was doing the, first of all, he was coming into the, at the end of his run, and adjusting the knobs in the cockpit, which adjusted the low speed and front, high speed front ride height and the rear ride height on the active control system he had that year. So he was adjusting that to a value which is completely different to what he's actually running. So that when Ricardo's race engineer would look over and write down the knobs, they're in completely different settings. And of course, Nigel's own race engineer was also writing down how he left it. They knew, nobody else in the crew did. So those shenanigans were going on. And I say, I understand why they did it, but it wasn't necessary because Nigel was already quick enough. He didn't need to do those games. And it did at times, from an engineering point of view, throw us as a team off in the wrong direction.
But I think despite that side of him, from reading the book, you have a certain amount of fondness for Nigel because you'd go Very out so. And you know there would be nothing left, you know, within him in terms of lap yeah. time, whereas Alan Prost, I think, was obviously quite a different character in terms of yeah. testing and things like yeah. that.
No, I think Nigel, you know, he was, the Italians from when he drove at Ferrari called him Il Leone, the lion. And he was a driver that when he was in the car, you could have painted his helmet white, you'd still know who was driving the car. He kind of really muscled the car around and bossed the car. And by and large, when he was in the car, you knew that that was going to be the time it was capable of that day. Whereas Alain Prost, the following year, could have hardly be a more extreme difference in the opposite direction. That Alain was, I suppose in many ways, perhaps it's a sign of self-confidence. He would not worry about lap time and testing or practice at all. He would kind of do his own thing to the point you think, Christ, we're in trouble here. We're just not quick enough. And then come qualifying, he would suddenly string it together and bang, there he was on pole, which I guess he knew what he was doing. But as I say, from the other side of the cockpit, it could be quite harrowing at times.
Do you think history's been a little bit unfair on Nigel Mansell? Do you think his talents are overlooked?
Yes, I do. I think he, in that active car, he was built for the active car, because it was, the control system had a lag in it, which meant that when you turned into a corner, then the kind of the outside front would collapse a bit, giving quite a strange feeling as the mechanical balance, the sort of distribution between front and rear tyres went peculiar. And then it would recover, and off it would go around the corner. That strange feeling on turning, Ricardo, it always spooked him, so he could never keep his foot in, whereas Nigel just had the self-confidence and self-belief in his own car control that he just kept his foot in it, and it would go round. Plus his huge upper body strength, which meant that because in those days we didn't have power steering, he could muscle the car around in a way that Ricardo just didn't have the strength on the steering wheel. I think he is underrated. And his contribution to the team, for me, from an engineering point of view, is also very good. He has this sort of image from the outside that he's, you know, a bit of a wide boy almost. But he was a clever chap in the cockpit.
We have loads of readers' questions, and I wanted to go on to talk about time at McLaren. But there's quite a nice one here that there's sort of two parts to this question. I'll read it out in its entirety. It's from Adrian King. But let's answer the second part first, and we'll go back to the first part. He's about to redecorate his house, and he's wondering whether duck egg blue is a good choice. We'll come back to that one. If you could have 10 minutes with Colin Chapman, what would you ask him?
I guess that's an interesting one. Nobody's ever asked me that one before. Probably, how does he go? How did he approach his work? What gave him the inspiration for some of his ideas? Having had an idea, what was his approach to developing it? And how do you put the discipline into when you say, actually, you know what, this idea is not going to work, it's time to ditch it and move on to something else? Because those are the kind of the problems I find myself facing, if you like, on a routine basis. And I'm sure everybody has a different way of dealing it, because sometimes actually coming up with the ideas is the easy bit. It's critiquing them and developing them into something that will work.
Before we get on to the critical matter of Duck Egg Blue, are your ideas, do they just sort of kind of pop up left field in the middle of the night? I mean, is it just a sort of methodical process by where you sit down and make a few notes and then you create the idea? I mean, or is it just literally something that pops into your head?
I'd say most of the time it's kind of looking at a problem, not having a solution to it, but it absorbs into your self-consciousness. Here's a problem, what do I do about it? And sometimes, you know, it'll be get up, go for a coffee, go for a walk, come back and you'll have a bit of inspiration just from turning your mind off and doing something mundane. What I find quite often is when I'm driving, my mind drifts off and I'm thinking about the car to the point that, you know, usual favourite, miss the motorway junction, etc. A number of times I've done that. Other times...
It's probably won you a couple of world championships, though, hasn't it? In missing motorway junctions, yeah, exactly. I'd have thought.
Yeah, it's put a fair bit on my journey time, but there we go. It's a great excuse for being late for work. Other times... It will be looking at things. So I remember, for instance, an internal flight in the Caribbean from Barbados to some little island, I can't remember the name. I was looking out the window and the solution the propeller aircraft had for its engine intake kind of looked the perfect solution when reapplied to the problems we were having in the airbox intake on the 96 car. And so based on that, I kind of drew a completely different roll hoop intake for the 97 car, which proved to be a good solution, I think has now become the universal solution along the grid. So inspiration can, I think if you, the key thing is to try and keep your mind open and working almost subconsciously, and then it seems to fit into place.
Well, we should return to Duck Egg Blue because it brings us nicely on to McLaren. I think sort of the listeners will probably need a small explanation in the answer to Adrian King's question.
Yes, there is a history to that, which was when I started at McLaren on the 1st of August, which is very late in a design period. Normally, kind of the car would be largely defined by the 1st of August. We also, that was 97, and we had a very big regulation change for the 98 season. So it's kind of doubly on the back foot, because I couldn't necessarily simply bring my memory of what the Williams car looked like, because it wouldn't have been appropriate, the regulation change. So the bottom line was, as soon as I started, then I was working crazy hours trying to catch up, and also, of course, understand the research that had been to that point had been done by the guys at McLaren up to that point, and try and best blend, if you like, my thoughts and ideas with their results to that date. The office I was given was John Barnard's old office, which was floor to ceiling mahogany panelling with black window frames, a mahogany desk and a dark brown carpet. So kind of when you're working to past midnight, it is kind of, you felt it was about time to do that, really. So Ron insisted I come to the Hungary race, which was about 2 weeks after I started. So just before I left, I said to the factory manager, look, here's a paint chart. Can you paint the walls that colour, please? Can you put a tan coloured carpet in and put a light... Oh, the seat, my chair was black as well, put a lighter tan coloured chair in, or do something, brighten it up. So he said, okay. Anyway, I came back in on the Monday morning after Hungary, and it was, you know, all the walls were duck egg blue. It was just so much lighter and kind of had a nicer, softer feel. And to the point that when I looked out of my door onto the main engineering office, which was all kind of in Ron's style, shades of grey, then it kind of looked like almost as if I was looking at one of those sort of old postcards where I was looking at the black and white, but my bit had been coloured in. It's a very funny feeling. Anyway, Ron came in that evening about kind of 6 or 7 o'clock to see how I was getting on. And bearing in mind, Ron doesn't like anything happening that he doesn't know about. He's quite a bit of a control freak in that sense. Anyway, came in and looked through my door, and he kind of went, and he started gulping like a goldfish. Or and meanwhile, his face went bright red. Oh, Christ, he's going to have a heart attack or something. And after what probably was 30 seconds, but seemed like about 2 minutes, he finally spun on his heels and walked out. I think the poor old factory manager had a huge strip torn off him. Apparently, I only found out years later that he went back to see his wife, Lisa, and was absolutely apoplectic about the whole thing. I think the honeymoon period was nearly over after 2 weeks for that little prank.
Keeping on the subject of Ron Dennis, despite working there for, you know, nearly a decade and having a 50% win rate, he then tried to cut your salary, didn't he? Which I think was sort of the beginning of the end, wasn't it, with McLaren?
Well, I think it's probably slightly before that, where we'd won the both drivers and constructors in 98, won the drivers in 99 and almost won the constructors, just had a bit of bad luck and so forth in that. And then in 2000, we were again leading the drivers with about two races to go, and we had an engine failure and that kind of put us out. So we'd had a decent run and quite a lot of race wins in that time. I guess it must have been early 2001 when my contract was getting to the point where it was close to expiring. Yes, it must have been about February, March 2001, with about 4 months to go on my contract. Renegotiations started. Now, about the same period, Ron invited Martin Whitmarsh, who was the managing director, and myself down to his house in south of France. And there in the swimming pool, the three of us, Ron said, I'd like you two to take the keys to McLaren when I retire. But I'm not going to retire. I'm not going to decide when I'm going to retire at the moment. It will be at some point, but I don't know when. And until then, I kind of want you to swear undying loyalty to McLaren and that was a sales pitch, really. And Martin said, okay, absolutely. And I said, well, no, I'm sorry, but I'm afraid I really enjoy working here, but I'm not prepared to do that with no defined timescale. And kind of that, Ron expected undying or unquestioning loyalty. And when I didn't show that, I think that was maybe a little, it definitely changed the relationship. And it was shortly after that we then got into these contract negotiations, where I'd had a pretty substantial joining fee when I first started at McLaren, plus a fairly good championship bonus. And so when renegotiations happened, I expected to at least be earning what I'd earned in the previous 3 years or so. And Ron instead came in with an offer which was much lower, and in the end I kept rejecting it. And I was kind of a bit upset about it, in truth, because I felt as if I was kind of being taken advantage of. Anyway, Bobby Rahal, who the driver from IndyCar, by then had become team principal at Jaguar, and he approached me and said, "What would it take you to? What would it take to get you to join Jaguar?" So we had various discussions. Initially just about the job and the direction and Jaguar's aspirations, which was Ford backed, so effectively Ford's aspirations, and their budgets for running the team and so forth. And then finally, of course, it turned around to my salary. And I can honestly say I've never moved teams for salary. In fact, sometimes I've moved teams for a drop in salary because I felt it's the career directions I wanted to take. But what Bobby was, or Jaguar were offering, was pretty very attractive compared to what I had been on at McLaren. And then when compared to Ron's reduced offer for me to continue, was kind of a very different level of offer. So I debated it and so on and so forth with my wife at the time, Marigold. And it did look attractive. I liked Bobby. And the working relationship, the relationship, not just the working relationship, between, if you like, the chief engineer and the, whatever adjective you want to use, team principal, which in this case was Bobby, I think is a very important one. Martin Whitmarsh and I sort of had that a very good relationship at McLaren, but as I say, it was starting to turn a bit. The honeymoon period was certainly over, and I thought, okay, well, you know, to work with Bobby, I got on tremendously with him when in my race engineering days with him as a driver. I know him very well. This could work. And so I was really right on the point of joining them. And I will be honest, I did actually sign a kind of letter of intention that I would join. Then went to see Ron and said, "Look, I'm sorry, this is what's happening. I'm going to join Jaguar and my contract expires." I then took the kids off to see The Mummy Returns at Woking Cinema. And when I came out, my phone was just got about 100 messages on it from everybody, going mainly Ron, and going nuts. So when I got home, Ron was there with his wife Lisa, ready to ambush me at the gates. Went inside, and Ron and Lisa are a very persuasive couple when they get going, and kind of did a good job of kind of pointing out what was actually correct in the end, that whilst Bobby was team principal at the time, there was other things going on underneath with Niki Lauda coming in. There was a power struggle between Niki and Bobby, et cetera, et cetera. And persuaded me that actually I should stay, and offered me the same salary as Jaguar had, and also offered me that if I wasn't enjoying it after a couple of years, then I could stop doing the Formula One bit and do McLaren would enter America's Cup. So I stayed at McLaren. And as I say, in truth, Ron turned out to be right, because after that, Jaguar went through this revolving door policy where Bobby only lasted about another 6 or 9 months after that. And then they got through a team principal year after that. It was a very kind of, Ford, I think, became very desperate, didn't know what to do, and just kept putting new people after new person in.
But you did, I suppose, in a sense, eventually join that team when it was Red Bull. And I must get on to readers' questions, but just a sort of a very quick question for you too, because we haven't talked at all about Red Bull, 4 back-to-back world championships. There's an interesting bit in your book about Helmut Marko, and obviously that post-collision in Istanbul, he very much jumped out in defence of Vettel, I think, having not really seen the footage or certainly not considered what he was saying. But he also lent into Mark's cockpit just before the Valencian race. Excuse the language, we said, Mark, you're always shit in Valencia. Is today going to be any different? Was he quite a difficult character, or is he a quite difficult character to have in the team when you've got someone like Vettel, who he's brought up from nothing, and then you've got someone else like Mark? Is it, that must be quite a difficult sort of balance to strike with someone like that?
Well, I think there's two things about Helmut, and I think it seems to be, as far as I can see, an Austrian thing. It's just a slight cultural difference that they tend to be very blunt. We English are kind of a bit more softer about the way we say things to people, whereas the Austrians very much say what they feel. So as far as Helmut was concerned, when he leant in the cockpit in Valencia, he was just stating a fact. The fact is, it was not the best motivational thing to say to a driver when he's about to start a race is completely lost on Helmut. Helmut offers a huge amount and does bring a lot to the team, but he also has his young driver program. And so, of course, for Helmut, if a driver comes through the young driver program, makes it to Formula One, and then turns out to be very good, that's a real feather in his cap. And Sebastian Vettel was really the first product of that young driver program that went on to be a proper star. Others got to Formula One, but weren't really top draw. So, whereas Mark has been a very successful driver before moving to Red Bull and had not ever been part of the Red Bull Junior program. So it is kind of understandable that Helmut had a bias towards Sebastian. He was probably a bit obvious and overt in the way he displayed that, let's say. And it's back to this thing of mind games. And I think for Mark, the truth is that Helmut's kind of bias towards Sebastian, in terms of the preparation of the car, the level of engineering that went into the car, the support that Mark got from myself, etc., was absolutely identical between the drivers. If anything, when it came to that 2010 championship, I would have loved to have seen Mark win it, because I felt, having been through the less good years of 2007 and 8 with us and stuck with us and given us a lot of support and a lot of feedback in helping to develop the car, to have won the championship in 10 would have been a very good reward, a just reward for him. But unfortunately, understandably, Mark, with his girlfriend Anne, started to become a bit... They spent too long worrying about that Helmut was favouring Sebastian's side, or paying too much attention to Sebastian's side of the garage. And that, I think, in terms of his driving, started to affect him a little bit. Because after all, drivers are sportsmen, and we're all... What goes on up here is all part of it.
We must ask some of these readers questions. There's some really great ones here, and I don't think we're going to get through the sort of several hundred that we have. And you probably want to have dinner at some point. There's a nice one here that from Peter Spears. He says, as a keen motorbike rider, have you ever been tempted to move into MotoGP? John Barnard worked with Kenny Roberts' team, and said that he considered the aero potential fascinating and largely untapped.
Yeah, no, MotoGP is, I think, outside of Formula One, what other areas of kind of man and machine, big budget man and machine, is there? And the answer is Le Mans, MotoGP, and America's Cup is probably, in truth, about it. MotoGP, obviously, not obviously, but I didn't have a car until I was about 22, 23. I just had motorbikes through my teens. So I have a great love of motorbikes. And quite a few people, John Barnard's one, but quite a few other people from the Formula One paddock have ended up in MotoGP. It's a very different challenge, for sure. And I think it's a challenge that one definitely shouldn't underestimate. So if I was going to divert to MotoGP, it would have to be as a full-time thing. It's not something I think you could really do as a consultant. And that's kind of never quite got to the top of my list. And I still enjoy Formula One, and I wanted to design a road car, and I'd like to get him, which is the Aston Martin Valkyrie project. And then the one thing I would like to try to achieve now, if it was possible, is if we are able to race the Aston at Le Mans, then to get a win at Le Mans, and hence an engineering triple crown of Monaco, Indy and Le Mans, would be something that would be very satisfying.
There's another one here about the three technical directors who you consider as your biggest rivals. They can be retired or still active. I think it'd be nice to sort of open it up to technical directors, but also engineers as well, and designers. Who do you see or have seen as really your, you know, you look at them and think, yeah, I've got to watch what they're doing?
I think from the previous era, before I got into motor racing really, or certainly was right at the end of the tail end of their careers, then it would have to be Colin Chapman and Mario Fegheri from Ferrari. And I think almost most of all, and very almost unknown, Jim Hall of Chaparral, who was responsible for a lot of the innovations that we now see in motor racing, or certainly developing them to the point they're on racing cars. If you like, Gordon Murray is in truth pretty much out of Formula One by the time I got into it. So Gordon Murray in the same category. Patrick Head, of course, who I worked with at Williams, very pragmatic engineer. And then I think Rory Byrne probably is the one I would single out as not being terribly well known, but in the years where Rory was at Benetton and then Ferrari, I would view much of that Benetton and Ferrari success as being Rory's work, and he's probably the engineer most of the ones I know that I have the most respect for.
I've got sort of one more question here, and then Simon, I'll throw to you for a final question. In your book, you say, I'd love to design a car aimed at the general road user, one that's affordable and economical, something that has a genuinely small carbon footprint. You mentioned Gordon Murray there. A period in F1, followed by building a hypercar or a supercar, and then building a car with a small carbon footprint. There's quite a lot of similarities with Gordon's career as well. Sort of tell me a bit more about your next steps, because obviously you've got the Valkyrie, maybe Le Mans. But also about whether that was any conscious decision to kind of mirror what Gordon's done.
Conscious decision with Gordon, no, it's not. I mean, I know Gordon quite well. And as I say, got a great deal of respect for him. So maybe it's just kind of what older Formula One people do, I don't know. I think in my case, my father had a series of sports cars, starting with Mini Cooper S's, then Lotus Elans in particular, and he used to tinker around and modify them quite a lot, and it was partly a result of his interest in those that I think kind of rubbed off into my interest in cars and motor racing. So road cars have always been a kind of quiet passion, and something I always really, from probably a very young age, always wanted to have a go at designing a road car. But of course, my motor racing career became the kind of dominant thing. But a few years ago, I thought, right, it's time to step back a little bit from Formula One, try and give more space for the very talented group of engineers also at Red Bull. And use that time to start getting involved in a road car, and that's exactly what we were able to do. But it's a very specialised car. You know, it's a very expensive car. Only a few people have that sort of wealth to be able to afford it. And obviously you can then discuss its value or true merit in terms of furthering mankind or whatever. So yes, I think perhaps because my father always loved small cars with the Mini Coopers and the Lotus Elans, which nowadays of course look tiny, then trying to do something which is trying to find a slightly new avenue to small, light, efficient cars would be a challenge that I may find a route to or not. It's not immediately obvious to me how you do that. Gordon's obviously tried to do it by going off and setting up his own company, but that's not something that really interests me. I enjoy engineering and design. I don't enjoy kind of trying to run companies and be a manager. That's not me at all. So there's a few ideas. It may or may not happen. And I think the automotive industry at the moment is clearly in a lot of turmoil. Nobody knows what is the future direction. Is it going to be electric? Is it going to be hybrids? Is it going to be hydrogen, which seems to me to be the much more logical approach rather than pure electric? The truth is nobody knows.
To sign off, one of the ways you relax when you're not in the maelstrom of Formula One paddock is to go and race things such as a Lotus 49. Is historic racing, I mean, you've had a GT40, you've had an E-Type, I think you've still got the 49, haven't you? Is that relaxation, or do you tackle the driving with the same kind of commitment that you tackle the engineering?
I think some of my early accidents would probably say that I tackled it with a bit too much commitment. But
I seem to remember for a Motorsport magazine feature, we got you into the Leighton House, and Christian Horner was heard on the pit wall saying, "Oh Jesus," as he went into Cops or wherever it was.
Yeah, I know what it's meant to be able to do. It's been relaxation, and probably it's that frustrated kid that went karting when I was kind of 14, 15. Never did any good. Obviously, I'll try and blame it on the equipment. And in truth, my main interest actually became modifying the kart to try and make it go faster more than driving it. But there's probably, like most people in motor racing, there's still that frustrated racing driver in there. And so doing a bit of racing, bit classic cars or indeed modern cars with a friend, Joe McCari. We've did quite a few races in a Ferrari 430, including Le Mans. Has been, I suppose it's been a hobby, and you might say that's a busman's holiday, but to me it's completely different because kind of, if you like, amateur racing as a driver is completely different to attempting to be a professional engineer in motor racing.
Adrian, it's been absolutely fascinating. Thank you so much for joining us. Have a wonderful dinner tonight. Simon, thank you very much. And thank you to Alan, who's been recording. If you haven't read it already, please go and buy Adrian's book. It is absolutely brilliant. It burnt my back because I found it so interesting when I was on holiday in the sun. And there's so much that we haven't covered today that is in that book. So thank you so much for listening. Thank you so much for watching. And we'll see you next time. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.